Welcome to this week's Science Podcast. I'm NPR science editor, Alison Richards. It was a big week for science news, so we're going to bring you some of the highlights. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris rattled a few cages when he asked three independent experts to analyse video of the oil spilling into the Gulf. What those experts came up with was that the spill could be 10 times bigger than either BP or the Coast Guard was saying. The new estimates were picked up around the world, got Congress moving, and, well, we'll bring you up to date in a minute or two. Before that, we have a major milestone on the way to creating artificial life. A new study that finds daddies get postpartum depression too. And we hear more calls for the government to tackle global warming, as well as for scientists to explain it better. You'll also get to take a trip with us way underground to visit some remote salt caverns full of nuclear waste. But to begin, a name you may be familiar with, Craig Venter. Remember him? He's the guy who went head-to-head with government scientists in the race to sequence the human genome. Venter does nothing if not think big. And his current project is to create artificial life forms. That means cells that can be tailor-made to do whatever you want them to do. Gobble up oil, make new fuels, churn out vaccines. He's just announced that he's well on the way to doing that. Venter's lab was able to build a synthetic genome, put it into a cell, switch it on, and lo and behold, it controlled how that cell functioned, just like normal DNA. Now that's a major, but some would say troubling, step on the way to creating life from scratch. NPR's Joe Palka has our report.
Many scientists have strong opinions about Craig Venter, but even his detractors will admit he's a man who thinks big. Venter famously took on the federal government in a race to be the first to sequence the human genome. Now he wants to create life, starting with the four chemical constituents of DNA known as A, T, C, and G that make up the genetic code.
Using those to actually write new chemical software and booting up that software to create new life forms.
Venter says there were two enormous hurdles to accomplishing his goals. First, he needed to figure out how to make a very big piece of DNA. Most chemical synthesis techniques stop working when you get to a few thousand letters of DNA.
We wanted to build something close to a million. So solving all the chemistry has taken much of the last 15 years.
Venter and his colleagues eventually solved this problem by putting smaller fragments of DNA they made in the lab into yeast cells and letting the yeast cells stitch the fragments together. The second hurdle was figuring out how to transfer such a large chunk of DNA into a cell without breaking it.
DNA becomes very brittle in large pieces.
Once they solved that, they needed the transplanted DNA to switch on, start running the show inside the cell. That last step turned out to be harder than Venter thought it would be. This is what he told me last June when I was working on a project for the National Academy Keck Futures Initiative.
Well, until we have a living organism totally derived from that genetic code, we won't have achieved the first synthetic cell.
Now, nearly a year later,
we're here today to announce the first synthetic cell.
At a news conference, Venter said he had succeeded in putting synthetic DNA into a cell and getting that cell to grow and divide, passing its synthetic genes on from one generation to the next.
I don't actually think that this work represents the creation of an artificial life form.
James Collins is a synthetic biologist at Boston University.
So its genome is a stitched-together copy of the DNA of an organism that exists in nature.
The genome the Venter team started with was from a living cell. Collins says making a precise copy of all that cell's DNA, moving it to a cell from a different species, and getting it to start working, it's a marvelous achievement, but it's not creating new life.
We don't know enough biology to create or synthesize life. I think we're far removed from understanding how would you build a truly artificial genome from scratch.
Even so, Venter's accomplishment is bound to raise questions about whether the work is morally acceptable. It's a discussion bioethicists have been having for some time.
It's not as though we've suddenly got to the point that particular moral issues are raised here that weren't already present in the field.
Gregory Kabnick is a scholar at the Hastings Center, a bioethics think tank. Kaepernick says there are two basic concerns about what Venter and others in the new field of synthetic biology are doing. First, that one of these synthetic organisms will escape from the lab and run amok. And second, whether this kind of work crosses a line where humans start playing God.
Up until now, organisms have come into being on their own, as it were. They've evolved on their own.
But Kaepernick says Venter's work says that may no longer be the case.
And for some, that's a troubling development.
But for Craig Venter, that's exactly the point of doing this work in the first place.
And we decided that writing new biological software and creating new species, we could create new species to do what we want them to do, not what they evolved to do.
Venter has founded a company called Synthetic Genomics, where he intends to use these new species to do things like make new fuels and new vaccines. For the moment, Venter and his colleagues are the only ones with the money and techniques to do this kind of genomic manipulation. But others are working in related areas, and a new world of synthetic microorganisms might not be far off. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Now, that oil spill. NPR's report that there could be up to 10 times more oil coming out of the Deepwater Horizon leaks than either BP or the government was saying prompted Congress to hold a hearing on how to measure the spill. And they asked the scientists we'd consulted to testify. Not surprisingly, NPR's Richard Harris was there.
Steve Worley went from being a respected but little-known engineering professor at Purdue University to being the center of attention last week. His claim to fame was producing, for NPR, a startling new estimate of the size of the Gulf oil spill. He said the flow coming out the end of the pipe could well be 10 times the size of the official figure. He used a well-established scientific technique called particle image velocimetry to measure flow from the largest of the three leaks near the seafloor. Worley has now analyzed the video of a second leak, and at a congressional hearing he said that leak alone appears to be bigger than the official estimate of 5,000 barrels a day.
What I get is 25,000 barrels a day coming out of that tiny hole. That's a 1.2-inch hole, and it seems incomprehensible that so much oil would be coming out of that hole.
But Worley says the oil in this part of the pipe is under tremendous pressure. Add to that last week's estimate of about 70,000 barrels a day, and his total is now approaching 100,000 barrels a day. And there's still another leak he hasn't even analyzed yet. Worley's flow rate includes both gas and oil, so he says his figures may come down once he sees enough video to be able to quantify the amount of gas.
But from what I see in the videos, I don't see them coming down, the numbers coming down that significantly.
Congressman Ed Markey, a Massachusetts Democrat, called Worley to talk to his committee. Markey noted the huge discrepancy between Worley's numbers and BP's off-quoted guesstimate, which is based on a survey of oil on the ocean surface.
What is the likelihood that BP is accurate?
I don't see any possibility, any scenario under which their number is accurate.
Worley told the committee he would like clean video from BP and lots of it in order to sort out how much of the flow is oil versus gas and to figure out if the flow has varied since it began nearly a month ago. BP has started to provide more video to a Senate committee, but the oil company rejected a plan that would have produced an independent measure of the oil flow. Richard Caminelli from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution told the committee he and a colleague had offered to put together an instrument that uses sound waves to measure underwater oil flow. He said BP was interested for reasons related to their broken equipment, not the environmental consequences. Caminelli said at 3 a.m. on May 5th he got an email from BP essentially giving the thumbs up. But then,
at 1 p.m. the next day, BP sent a message putting the project on hold.
BP said it was turning its attention to the containment dome. Turns out that didn't work, but even so,
our team was thanked politely by BP representatives for our efforts, and I've had no further communication with BP since May 6th.
Caminelli said he hoped to use the information about oil flow to help scientists measure the magnitude of a spill that's not only on the surface of the ocean, but also spreading deep underwater.
Understanding and knowing the total amount of oil that has been released is going to be critical so that we know how much was on the surface, we know how much remains subsurface, and we can track it and attempt to mitigate it.
BP's position all along has been that they're making an all-out effort to contain the spill, so putting a number on the outflow isn't a priority. Congressman Markey took issue with that.
This faulty logic that BP is using, of course, is unfortunately raising real concerns that they are hiding the full extent of the potential damage of this leak.
Markey scored one small victory yesterday. The Coast Guard told him he could post BP's live video of the oil and gas spewing out of the pipe on his congressional website. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And the Gulf isn't the only gloomy environmental story. The nation's preeminent scientific organization weighed in this week on climate change. They confirmed humans are definitely warming the Earth. But as Christopher Joyce reports, they also told the government, in no uncertain terms, to do something about it.
The National Research Council is where Congress and the government go to get answers to tricky scientific questions. It's part of the National Academy of Sciences and essentially deputizes science's top guns to tackle those questions. Today, though, it was Robert Fry, an MBA, an energy analyst at the economic think tank Resources for the Future, who summed up the NRC panel's view on climate change.
A principal conclusion of our report is that the country needs both a prompt and a sustained national commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
That's mostly carbon dioxide, mainly from burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. Although the report leaves the decision-making to politicians, it does get more prescriptive than previous Academy climate studies. For example, it states that the annual emissions from American factories, power plants, cars, agriculture, and the like, it's about 7 billion tons of greenhouse gases, must be cut at least a third. The report says total emissions over the next 40 years should not exceed 200 billion tons.
How hard is it to do the job? Well, it turns out meeting that emissions budget is a very challenging task.
One says Fry that will require a price on carbon emissions as well as inventing technologies that don't even exist yet. What does exist now is scientific evidence of warming. But earth scientist Pam Mattson from Stanford University, who led the report section on the state of the science, says measuring what's happening now isn't enough anymore.
The scientific community would say this is a core fact, basically, that climate is changing. We also have a lot more lines of evidence now indicating that humans are, in large part, the reason that increase in temperature is occurring. What we haven't done as much of is focus our attention on what to do about that.
The report says scientists need to spend more time figuring out what's going to change. For example, how will higher temperatures affect agriculture, and where and when? Mattson says that's a moving target, and it's largely guided by how much fossil energy people will be using.
There are a lot of uncertainties about the future, and the uncertainties are in large part because we don't know what people are going to do.
And what people do, Mattson adds, may depend on how well scientists explain what they know.
We miscommunicate all the time. For example, we use the term uncertainty all the time in science. It represents a quantitative statement of how well we know something. But think of what uncertainty means for most people. It means we don't know.
The point of this report, she and its authors say, is to show that scientists do know that something must be done to keep the Earth's climate from heading into uncharted territory. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
It's well known that mothers can suffer severe depression after giving birth. But it now appears they're not the only ones. Joanne Silberna discovers that some fathers of newborns can suffer their own kind of postpartum depression.
We're not talking about the normal reactions to the stress of dealing with a new baby. We're talking about the kind of depression that hit Chris Hale of Athens, Georgia.
You're supposed to be really happy when you have a baby, and you're supposed to be joyful, but I just felt empty. I felt like there was something that was missing. I had a really hard time holding my daughter.
Psychologist James Paulson of Eastern Virginia Medical School gathered up 43 surveys done around the world that asked new fathers and about-to-be fathers questions like, have you lost the ability to feel joy? Has your appetite changed dramatically? Are you able to engage with other people? Paulson found the incidence of depression was 10% in these fathers, about twice the normal rate, and spiked to 26% when their children were 3 to 6 months old. Paulson says birth is tough psychologically.
It takes a lot of work and a lot of coping to make it through that and maintain your mental health. So certainly that kind of stressful period can really activate vulnerabilities that people might have and cause folks to have a lot of difficulty and have emotional problems like depression.
The study was a meta-analysis, actually a compilation of studies. And, says Gregory Simon of the nonprofit Group Health Research Institute, the results are convincing. He was not involved with the research.
The message that postpartum depression is an important problem among men as well as among women, that seems to be clearly true.
Many people suspect that women's postpartum depressions are due to hormonal changes, which leads to the conclusion that men wouldn't get it. But Paulson notes the hormonal connection isn't proven, and new dads and moms have many of the same stressors.
Change in the relationship between mom and dad, financial stress, sleeplessness and fatigue, just a complete change in role in life. So going from a single person to a parent is a real shock and a real surprise to a lot of people. And that certainly can affect fathers just like it can affect mothers.
When mothers are depressed, fathers have a moderately higher risk of getting depressed themselves. Joel Schwartzberg of Montclair, New Jersey, didn't know what hit him after his baby boy came home from the hospital. The new father was extremely sad and hyper-irritable. He gained 10 pounds eating donuts.
I didn't think of it as depression at the time. I really thought of myself as a failed father, as a, you know, that I had a flaw in my fatherhood gene that made it impossible for me to really bond and really enjoy the experience.
Schwartzberg says he felt like a wrecking ball had hit him. By the time he realized he had a problem, his marriage had failed. Researcher James Paulson says ignoring a father's depression can be bad news for the family.
This is really a dangerous and a problematic thing to ignore and to not recognize. And there's evidence that's growing now that suggests that depression in fathers is actually a problem for children and that it can negatively affect children and it can increase the risk of emotional and behavioral problems as they grow up and it can increase the risk of psychiatric disorders.
In a way, Paulson says that's remarkably similar to if the mother has postpartum depression. Treatment depends on the severity of the depression. Sometimes just talking about it can help. Or Paulson says it could take drugs or group therapy or counseling. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
We end, maybe, on a more positive note. But that all depends on where you're standing, of course, especially if you live in New Mexico. If you drill down deep enough in part of southern New Mexico, you eventually hit pure salt. And for over a decade, the federal government has been using that salt to store the nuclear waste left over from making atomic bombs. Now that the government is looking for an alternative to Yucca Mountain as a place to put thousands of tons of spent fuel from nuclear reactors, Christopher Joyce discovered that some people in New Mexico are saying, yes, we'll take it.
You'll find Bob Forrest at the Stevens Hotel in the faraway desert town of Carlsbad, New Mexico, sipping an iced tea in the restaurant. He owns the hotel, and he was mayor twice. Say the word salt, and he grins.
The biggest asset we have are those salt beds out here east of town. Been there for 250 million years, and they've just proven perfect to put this kind of waste and to store it permanently, and that's the key to our success.
The success he means is WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant run by the U.S. Department of Energy. It's the nation's only permanent geological nuclear waste dump. It costs about $235 million a year to run WIP, and a lot of that comes here to Carlsbad. That also means jobs, about 1,400 of them, from mining engineers to safety officers.
For your personal safety, you must comply with all posted safety, security, and informational signs.
It's about a 26-mile ride to get to WIP, plenty of time to watch the mandatory DOE video. There's a big fence around WIP, of course. Once inside, it's a collection of big metal buildings and tall steel structures that lower and raise miners, equipment, and salt through vertical shafts. First, you suit up. A leather belt with emergency air breather, a hard hat with a miner's lamp, and a matchbox-sized radiation monitor. Then it's into a 4x4-foot cage for a trip down into the mine with Chief Scientist Roger Nelson.
Yeah, so right about being tight quarters.
Oh, it's not bad. We all took showers this morning.
First time under?
In a salt mine, yes.
We're going to go underground at about 800 feet a minute, so it's about a 3-minute trip to get there.
What we're plummeting down almost half a mile to see are caverns mined out of the salt beds. This is a good place for waste because the beds are dry. There's no groundwater in them, although there's some water trapped inside individual crystals. Studies suggest that's not enough water to move the waste outside the salt bed. Nelson points out that what does move here are the walls and the floors.
Salt at very high pressures, half a mile underground, behaves different than salt at the surface. Salt moves like a viscous plastic or like cold molasses.
Over the next few decades, these caverns will slowly close up like a healing wound.
The floor's wet. Be careful. Watch your step.
We climb into an electric cart. The tunnels are tall and wide and a sort of mottled off-white. Roof bolts and wire netting keep them secure. The wheels of the cart crunch over loose salt.
Pull that green cord for me. Now we're going to go through an airlock.
Giant doors are airlocks that separate the dim rooms and tunnels to control the flow of air through the mine. What's buried here is mostly plutonium waste left over from making nuclear weapons. Glove boxes and gloves, some dirt, tools, solid chemicals. It's trucked here from government sites around the country and stacked in cul-de-sacs in these caverns.
These are just normal 55-gallon drums, those green ones there in the foreground.
Nelson says if you stood next to one of these drums for 5 hours, you'd probably get about as much radiation as you would in a chest X-ray. There is also a more radioactive class of military waste here. It's buried inside the walls, secured with concrete plugs like corks in a wine bottle. Once the repository is filled, in about 6 years, nature will take its course and the caverns will finally collapse.
All of the containers will slowly crush, and then the salt will continue to fill in until it's basically an encapsulated layer about 10 feet thick, with 1,000 feet of salt above it and another 1,000 feet of rock above that, and several thousand feet of salt below it.
So far, 8,500 waste shipments have been trucked into WIP and buried without serious incident. The State Environment Department says WIP's safety record is good, and that's kept WIP out of the newspapers. But not anymore. That's because the federal government needs a place to dump thousands of tons of its most highly radioactive waste, spent fuel from reactors, someplace safe for tens of thousands of years. It was supposed to go into Yucca Mountain in Nevada, but that project has been canceled. Former Carlsbad Mayor Bob Forrest says, why not WIP?
It's just a no-brainer, and why would DOE ever walk away from the most successful project they've got? I mean, they don't have a hell of a lot of great stories to tell, but this is the number one.
President Obama has appointed a panel of experts to look for a high-level waste dump for spent fuel, and salt beds are expected to be on its list. But despite Bob Forrest's enthusiasm, there are also plenty of people here who say, no thanks, we've done enough. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
You can hear Chris's second piece from New Mexico, as well as a discussion of the issues raised by Venter's synthetic cells, by going to npr.org/science. We'll be back again next week. Thank you for listening. Until then, I'm Alison Richards.